The Who were to play on day two of the festival, the last show Saturday night, following Sly and the Family Stone and Janis Joplin. Someone suggested that because of problems on the local roads, we should leave early for our set. Karen and I made a quick decision that the baby needed peace and quiet, so I would go to the festival site alone. I slipped into my Doc Martens, my white boiler suit, and we climbed into a limo. Our driver said the helicopters had stopped flying when the charter company realized they weren't going to get paid. Wiggy's ears pricked up. He was responsible for collecting our fee. It took 90 minutes to drive 2 miles along a road so muddy that occasionally we needed to be pushed by passers-by. The road was littered with abandoned motorcycles and cars, some still containing tents and other belongings. It looked like a wartime flight. John and Keith were behaving strangely in the car. We'd only been in the hotel for 15 minutes and they'd managed to score dope. The scene greeting us at the backstage area of the festival was horrific. The entire parking area was a slurry of thick, gelatinous mud. The backstage crew were covered in it, and their travels back and forth to the stage were traipsing mud everywhere. As I got out of the car, I slipped and sank up to my knees. There were no dressing rooms available, so we went to a tent with a hot water machine, tea bags, instant coffee, and a coffee dispenser. I helped myself and within minutes realized the water had been spiked with acid. It was fairly dilute, but as the low-level trip kicked in about 20 minutes later, I noticed a photo of Meher Baba posted high on a telegraph pole. It was a wonderful moment. The image was ubiquitous at the time. Meher Baba as a young man, handsome, long-haired, Christ-like. It felt like a sign to me that everything would be okay. Then tragedy struck. As I gazed at the photo, a young man, barefoot and shirtless, clearly out of his head, leapt up on the roof of an ambulance parked under a telegraph pole and gracefully shinned up some 30 feet. As he touched the photo, he screamed and fell backwards, landing on top of the ambulance. The telegraph pole was, in fact, a power line. The paramedics ran out to attend to the unconscious man. When I went into the first aid tent to investigate, I thought I'd just walked onto the set of MASH. There were cots of patients everywhere, mainly young people on bad trips, but some injured, mostly kids suffering from bouts of terror. Back outside the tent, I saw the faces of John and Keith peeping out from the back window of a station wagon. They waved and grinned. Later, I learned that each of them had a girl's mouth around their cocks. I walked alone along the edge of the main field where most of the audience gathered. Rumour had it that over 1 million people had come to Woodstock, and it looked like half that number were scattered on the hill. The light was fading fast as I entered an eerie woodland scene. Naked fairies danced between the trees, dealers carrying trays of ready-made joints, tabs of acid, hash, grass, and rolling papers. As I broke through the woods, I came across the open area where most of the campers were strewn about. Thousands sat listening to the music pulsating up the hill from the stage, as though in a natural amphitheatre. The sound system wasn't bad, but neither was it designed to cover such a massive area. Occasionally, someone would try to engage me, sometimes a loved-up soul on a trip, smiling and kind, sometimes another overstocked boy like the one on the pole, demanding money or drugs, threatening violence, then laughing and running away at lightning speed like a woodland sprite. The highlight that night had been Sly and the Family Stone, who had whipped the crowd into a muddy lather with, "I want to take you higher." Instead of acid, they must have been doing cocaine. The music was urgent, dark, and powerful. By now, in the early morning hours, Janis Joplin was finishing her encore, Ball and Chain, which would cap the last set before ours. She'd been amazing at Monterey, but tonight she wasn't at her best, probably due to the long delay and probably too to the amount of booze and heroin she'd consumed while she waited. But even Janis on an off night was incredible. As our turn on stage approached, I worried about losing the effect of the stage lights. I asked someone what time the sun was going to rise. As we set up our gear and began to play, some of the people in sleeping bags started rubbing their eyes and sitting up. As usual, I was pounding around like a frothing pony, fighting to keep my Gibson SG in tune, constantly fiddling with my amplifiers. Whoever was doing the lights had chosen white lamps for Roger, so his long, curly hair looked like golden fire. He was mostly singing with his eyes firmly closed. Suddenly, someone appeared at Roger's feet holding a big film camera. Roger nearly tripped over him, so I pushed the invader back down into the press pit in front of the stage. It turned out to be Michael Wadley filming the documentary that would make Woodstock legendary. Vulnerable now, Roger moved in ways that seemed to mean something deeper. His whirling microphone and mythical poses suggested frustration and pain, his sweat an angelic sheen that evoked an old master painting. By contrast, John and Keith were laid back. They dropped acid and consorted with a couple of friendly fans, and it showed. Skilled musicians that they were, however, they were still able to follow my lead. As we started to play Acid Queen, I put myself into character, imagining myself as the black-hearted gypsy who'd promised to bring Tommy out of his autistic condition but was actually a sexual monster, using drugs to break him. As I walked to the mic stand, someone stepped in front of me, trying to stop the music. It was Abby Hoffman. "This is a crock of shit," he shouted into the mic, waving his arms at the audience. "My friend, the Detroit poet John Sinclair, is in jail for one lousy joint." He got no further. Still playing the Acid Queen intro and still feeling malevolent, I knocked Abby aside using the headstock of my guitar. A sharp end of one of my strings must have pierced his skin because he reacted as though stung, retreating to sit cross-legged at the side of the stage. He glowered at me, his neck bleeding. I finished the song and looked over at him. "Sorry about that," I mouthed. "Fuck you," he mouthed back and left the stage. I was always absurdly territorial about our performance space. This may have been instilled in me as a little boy with my father's band, the Squadronaires. The stage was sacrosanct. By the time we hit I'm Free, most of the audience was on its feet. Before I knew it, Roger was singing, "See me, feel me, touch me, heal me," to waves of young people who suddenly realized that Tommy was music unwittingly designed for precisely this kind of festival, for this particular moment, for them. At one point, Keith shouted, "For Christ's sake, Pete, no more!" I went into a long, feedback-rich guitar solo as the sky behind the hillside began to pale with the first signs of dawn. Ebullient but weary, I struck my guitar on the floor a few times, tossed it into the audience, and the Who went back to London.